Welcome to Life 2.0. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me one more time. I appreciate all the emails and letters and texts. Wait, nobody gets letters anymore. I shouldn't say that. I'd like to get letters that are in the mail that aren't like a bill. Let's just say email. Letters. That's like 19th century stuff. Maybe early 20th. Certainly not 21st century. Nobody gets letters anymore. But I digress. I did that show on Monday, which was a Memorial Day special, and I had Brian Jopek on, and he talked about the difficulty of not only being a soldier himself, but serving at the very same time that his son Ryan David was killed in action in 2006. And had a little bit of a clip of Greg Daniels in there, who had to say goodbye to his son Nicholas in 2011. And the ripple effect from that, the amount of response I got was pretty much overwhelming to me. These are not easy shows to do. I shudder every time I try to put them together in a certain way so they make some sort of sense out of the senseless, because sending boys off to war and having to bury your sons and daughters is makes no sense to me, but it is the way of the world. And I'm glad that there was value found in there for the people that listened to it. And I'm becoming a rally cry, because I have a real hard time. Even today, there's commercials still running. Get in on the final days of the happy Memorial Day sale when you're buying a mattress. Okay, Memorial Day is over. Kill the commercial run and stop saying happy Memorial Day. And I think we'd all be a little bit better off. There is a difference between a Memorial Day and Veterans Day. I'll be pounding this drum until I'm not around. Please learn the difference. We're glad as veterans that you thank us for our service. Just don't do it on Memorial Day. The other thing that was in the headlines this week that is hard to get around every Memorial Day, especially here in Chicago, is it's like an open season on other humans. It's the official start of summer, and that's when certain people who live in the Chicago area lock and load and start hammering each other literally into the ground. And 41 people were shot, 7 were killed in Memorial Day weekend gun violence. That is nothing new here. Every year, it's interesting because the numbers fluctuate. If it's a rainy weekend, people don't go out and shoot each other as much. They call it a success. And it was kind of up and down this weekend with the weather, but it was apparently warm enough to go out and shoot 41 people. So one of the things that caught my eye in there, and how this ties into the episode today, which we'll get to in a little bit, is on the Chicago Sun-Times website, there's a picture of a couple of police officers outside of their cruisers, and it says they're investigating the scene where a man was shot in the 2200 block of South California Sunday morning in the Little Village neighborhood. And it was just an incredible opportunity for me to go back to that area of Chicago where most of the headlines are about loss and talk about gain. In the early 1990s, Nellie Vasquez Roland and her husband Brian were flourishing in the financial field. She was a successful financial advisor managing the portfolios of the wealthy. He did index arbitrage at the Chicago Board of Trade, profiting from the market inefficiencies. And then the bottom fell out. Brian was addicted to alcohol. He eventually got sober, discovered the services of those in recovery, and the couple began investing in real estate, buying abandoned Chicago apartment buildings during that era's economic downturn. First, they rehabbed a 13-unit building in Logan Square, and they rented it for a year to people recovering from drug and alcohol addiction. When the market recovered, they figured they'd sell it and reap their profit. But that day never came. What did happen is all that follows with a safe haven, and they have a huge vision for this. And I had a chance yesterday to sit down with Nellie Vasquez Roland in her office at Safe Haven, and it went a little bit like this.
We have a big vision. You mm-hmm. know, we were just waiting for the rest of the world to catch up with our vision, because, you know, the idea of, you know, the opiate epidemic, you know, the idea of investing in distressed communities is something we've been doing, talking about and doing, you know, for the last 25 years. So today, you know, there definitely are issues that have bubbled up to the surface, and we are ready to scale, you know. And I just came from a onboarding session, you know.
And what is that?
We have about 10 new employees starting, you know, right now. And I think that, you know, as I went around the room and I asked each and every one of them as to, you know, what brought them to A Safe Haven, you know, I love their responses in that across the board. They're passionate, you know, about wanting to help people. They're passionate about the idea of working here because they've never seen a place, and there really isn't a place that you can go to where you can literally start over, you know, and no matter where you start from, you know, whether you're starting from having been homeless for 30 years or, you know, escaping a domestic violence situation or coming out of prison or a veteran coming home trying to gun track, you know, we're able to really meet you where you're at and address the root causes and connect the dots with all the right services so that you're not running all over town, you know, and if you are, it's done in a really organized, coordinated way. You know, this building houses about 400 people. And literally people can come in the building, get three healthy meals a day, get a semi-private suite, whether it's for them and other single adults, two or three, based on the size of this room, you know. And also they can bring their children, and a mother can be in a room all by herself with their children. Isn't that nice to give them the dignity that they need and they deserve? And by doing that, we're providing them, you know, the essentials. But then after that, we get a chance to really assess, you know, physically, education-wise, work-wise, what's going on with this individual, and how do we connect them to the right services at the right time so that when they leave here, they have their life back on track. They have the ability to support themselves. They have the ability to, you know, move into an apartment or move back with their family in a way that's going to be more sustainable. So, you know, Safe Haven's a very unique model because even outside of our organization in terms of the social services, we've got a couple of different verticals. We've got the social services, which provides the transitional housing, all the wraparound services. We also provide employment. So we have social enterprises. So you might be seeing our landscaping trucks all over Michigan Avenue, Wacker Drive. We do a lot of public school systems. We also bid a lot of private work. We're putting at least 100 people to work every year in those jobs. And we also have housing. So we do supportive, affordable, senior, and veteran housing. So right now we have about, you know, four projects, real estate developments that we're working on. We currently have about 40 real estate developments. So we're growing every day. And down the street here in North Lawndale, we're excited about the opportunity of bringing a 90-unit veteran housing project here. It's going to be brand new. On Roosevelt Road, right a little west of California. The views are going to be magnificent because they're going to be overlooking Douglas Park. And it's another way to anchor the community. You know, we're bringing currently the property that we're going to be building on is mostly vacant land. It's been vacant forever. You know, it's a closed currency exchange. I mean, it's property that isn't productive right now, and we're turning it into something really positive, you know, for our veterans, right?
Thank you for doing that. As a Coast Guard veteran myself, I thank you for that. You were telling me when I came into the room about this event you just had for the veterans. What was that? Like 500 showed up?
Yeah. So about 2 weeks ago, we held a military veteran stand down. And to the veteran community, that's really a great opportunity to connect veterans with direct services. So it's a fair where you bring in healthcare providers, you bring in education organizations like universities and colleges, you bring employers and housing providers, for example, and social service providers, job training providers. And these vets get to come to this event where we had about 80 vendors there this year. And they're able to get direct services. They get their blood pressure checked, their eyes checked, their ears checked, free haircuts. They get to go to look at the different types of housing opportunities that are out there that they may have access to, you know, universities that may have some, you know, scholarships for them, and also employers that have jobs. So this year, we're really proud to have hosted about 500 military veterans. We had about 80 vendors there. And I was really proud of the people that came out to support it in terms of leadership. So we had speakers that are making major commitments to help our veterans in terms of providing employment opportunities, such as the aviation commissioner, Jamie Ree, was there. She shared a little personal story about the fact that her father was a Vietnam vet, and he was one that didn't make it back home. So she is truly committed and has been for many years to Safe Haven and the work that we've been doing with the city. Also, we had the new executive director for the tollway, Jose Alvarez, came out. The tollway, by the way, and the aviation both had boots there. So, you know, he came in and also declared, you know, that the tollway, and, you know, having been a former board member of the tollway, talked about the fact that, you know, the tollway is very committed to making sure that veterans get jobs and actually veteran-owned businesses businesses get access to jobs, contracts. Mm-hmm. So I'm really proud as a board member that I was the first board member to participate in helping a veteran get their very first prime contract there. Mm-hmm. So really important. We also had the Cook County Veterans Affairs Director there, Bill Brown, who we've worked with side by side for many, many years. I was really excited to have the Regional Director for HUD, the Housing and Urban Development there, Joe Galvan. He's also serves as the chair for the Federal Executive Board. And that's exciting to me because A Safe Haven actually has been working with HUD, forever as well, because all funding for housing, for the homeless and for supportive housing and even vouchers comes from HUD, So right. Everything that they do in terms of policy has everything to do with whether or not we're going to have funding to do what we do.
Right.
So he was there, and A Safe Haven, by the way, has been named a demonstration project by HUD, too. And who am I missing? I guess that pretty much sums it up. My husband and myself.
Your husband's a veteran.
My husband's a veteran, exactly. Yes. He's a veteran. And so when we started A Safe Haven, it wasn't lost on us the fact that, so many of the homeless happen to be veterans, which just seemed disproportionate to the population at large. There's studies that show that over 10% of the homeless actually wore a military uniform.
Yeah. I always say when you squeeze oranges, you get orange juice. Mm. When you squeeze tomatoes, you get tomato juice. When you squeeze people, all kind of shit comes out. and that's good or bad. I asked you one question. You talked for no, listen, follow me here. You talked for about 6 minutes, and when I squeeze you, this is what comes out. Where does it start in you? You're from this area. You grew up in Little Village. What you just went on this rant, which is wonderful. This is your fuel, isn't it? What is it in you that drives you like this? What is the impetus?
Well, we've been doing this for 25 years, and I've never lost passion.
Apparently not.
People say, did you just start this? Because you seem really excited. Well, by the way, I just want to correct myself. I did remember there was another regional director that came in that was the Social Security Administration was there. Mm. Nothing starts without getting a Social Security number people that we serve. So I was really happy to have him there as well. But it is personal to us.
What's the flick point for you? You have quite a background. Mm-hmm. Quite a background. Matter of fact, I've read your bio. You had quite a career in finance, but you're from this area. Somehow you took all that information and all that experience and you built this when you could have been building other things. Why?
Well, I guess we all are the sum of our, history and our parts, right? And what started out as Nellie from Little Village, and all those experiences in terms of having lived in an environment where it was gang infested, drug infested, half the people that I went to school with never graduated from high school, a lot of them ended up in the system. And, for some reason I got lucky and got an opportunity to go to college. I paid my way.
Stop. What do you mean lucky? Like a wand touch you on the head or you worked really hard and what happened?
Well, I did end up doing good in school, eventually. I didn't start out doing good in school because it wasn't a priority for me. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, I finished strong. And
where'd you go to high school?
I went to Jones. It used to be called Jones Commercial.
Oh, okay.
Which was, kind of a... job training program.
Yeah, right, right, right.
So I kind of went through a job training program myself mm-hmm. in high school.
I see.
And thank God I did because it was my training at Jones Commercial that got me the types of jobs that allowed me to pay for my own college, right? Mm-hmm. And so when Brian and I met in college, he had his own setbacks having come back from the military and, having gone through treatment and me being the friend, that was helping him through that journey, I learned a lot from his experience. And it never, I never forgot the fact that so many of the people that I grew up with could have sure used, the type of money that it took to go to treatment, like he did, and come back, unscathed and be able to get his life back on track. But that wasn't the reality for the people that I grew up with. And thank God things went well. I got an opportunity. I got lucky again, and got a job in finance. And ended up, you know, carving out a niche for myself.
Did you have an aptitude for it? Were you attracted to it? Did you learn it?
I had no interest.
Really? Really?
Beginning. I just didn't have a job for the first time in my life. And my husband, who was my friend at the time, Brian, you know, was getting a little annoyed that he was working at the Board of Trade, and he'd call me up to see what I was doing, you know, after we graduated from college. And my response was, you know, I haven't figured it out yet. I'm just going to go hang out at the beach. I'm meeting some really nice people with boats. And you know, we just got to get out on those yachts and have some fun, you know, make up for lost time because I worked so hard, you know, during college and high school. And he said, you know what, Nellie, I think I'm going to help you get a job. So he reached out to a friend of ours who we graduated from college with, who's actually the guy that introduced us, who got a job in finance at a brokerage firm. And he got me an interview. Mm-hmm. So between the two of them, they plotted to get me a job in finance.
It was inevitable.
It was inevitable. So I got, you know, the job. And once I got in, I knew I was in way over my head. Mm-hmm. First of all, I didn't have a golden Rolodex, you know.
Sure.
And in those days, those were the type of people that got those kinds of jobs, who were trust fund kids. There were people that actually had, you know, access to resources and people. And I knew nobody that had a lot of money. I had never invested in a stock in my life. So to answer your question, I had to learn really fast, you know, how to make this a successful. I didn't want to let my friends down. You know, they believed in me. Hmm. And it wasn't looking so good at the beginning. And I realized that, you know, what I had to bring to the table was absolutely not what these people that were working with me, who were doing well, had. So I had to figure out, how do I make it so that what I'm bringing to the table is authentic, but also helps them make money.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story short, I ended up specializing in emerging markets and started investing in Latin America when nobody was paying attention to those markets. So I was a very early adopter and went out to Mexico and started talking to the investment firms and became a subject matter expert. And there was somebody by the name of Carlos Slim who was buying a lot of the stuff that I was buying mm-hmm. in those markets. And I didn't know who he was, but turns out he bought a lot more stock than I did, because his you know, his legacy is today, he's one of the wealthiest men in the people in the world.
Wow.
And but you know, it really was something that, you know, I learned that I had to do my research, you know, I had to trust my instincts, and I just had to go for it.
And then where did the paths cross that ended and this started to be? It's obvious listening to you that so much of what you learned prepared you for what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. Where was the crossroad for that? What happened to make this a reality and leave that world?
Well, I wish I could point to one you know, instance, but it was actually the idea that we started to have children, you know, and we wanted to be good examples for our kids. And we were blessed to have been given opportunities and to have the resources to give back. And when we started doing our research and said, well, what would be the charity that we want to give to that would be aligned with our values and help people that have fallen on hard times get back on their feet? Because in both instances, whether Brian or mine, you know, could it ended differently if we had gone down that slippery slope? So we wanted to make sure that, you know, what we were doing was going to be helping people like us, right? And when we did our research at the time, there was not really a charity that really made the commitment to solve the root causes as to why people are in crisis. There were places you can go to sleep at night, you know, overnight shelters.
Sure.
There were places where you can go into food pantry lines and get, food, you know, for the week. There were job training organizations out there. There might have even been some treatment programs, but there really weren't, because there were a lot of treatment dollars that were being cut out of the system.
And it's kind of all band-aid on an amputation kind of thing, right?
Exactly.
Stopgap. Yeah.
Exactly. So for us, since we couldn't find a charity that really made the commitment to break the cycle of poverty or addiction.
Created one?
We created one.
Which is what most people do, right? No, they don't. They just stop.
But we were just going to do it for a little while.
Sure.
We just said, no, we were just trying to help a few people out. So we decided we wanted to buy real estate anyway. You know, the economy was in a recession at that time, and I was investing in real estate investment trusts. So I convinced myself and my husband, and we said, look, let's just buy some bricks and mortar and we'll make an investment. You know, we'll look at some communities that maybe there's going to be some, you know, turnaround and, you know, we'll buy early and then we'll sell later.
Sure. And you'll do a good thing in the meantime.
Exactly. Wow. So we just got a little carried away because when we started buying these buildings, we renovated them. We decided that the people that we were walking over that were squatters in these buildings really needed a little bit of help. What would happen if we actually offered it to them and allowed them to live in our apartments that were completely renovated, fully furnished, beautiful, beautifully landscaped apartments, and let people that had fallen on hard times live there and give them some rules, like say, look, you can't use drugs. You know, you have to listen to the recommendations to, you know, live a 12-step program, for example, and, you know, start going to these training programs that are out there. And, you know, as long as they kept doing everything that we asked them to do, they can live there for free.
And what was their response?
People came in droves.
Really?
People came in droves. So before you know it, we filled up one building, which was a 13-unit apartment building, which probably ended up having about 36 beds, you know, in it. Then we ended up buying three more apartment buildings in Rogers Park. They were all big crack houses. We gutted them, renovated them, again, turned them into the crown jewel of the community. Alderman Moore, who just, you know, finally was relieved of his services, right? was an amazing champion for us. You know, it's not easy to go into a community and say, look, we want to help, you know, take sure. these buildings, but we don't want to do the traditional, we're going to rent to people approach. We're going to help people that are in crisis. Are you okay with that? Well, he wasn't getting very many offers at the time.
Sure.
You know, it was a pretty bad neighborhood and bad things were happening. And here we came in and we were just offering, you know, to help and take some of the biggest properties that were the biggest eyesores and the biggest problems in his community and take them off his hands and turn them into, you know, viable, beautiful buildings that we'll be paying taxes on. Mm-hmm. But we just, you know, we're going to be doing a little bit of a twist in terms of helping some people, which he didn't understand. Nobody did, you know, but it worked out.
Well, it didn't make business sense. Why would you do all that and then put people in that? Right.
It made no business sense to anybody but us because for us, it was still a real estate investment, you know, and we were mitigating our downside because our appreciation, you know, of the properties was going up. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we felt really good doing it. And why not? Right.
And the people that came in droves, once they had a place like that and they had a little bit of dignity, what happened?
Then they started to live up to our expectations. It's like magic, you know, when you surround people with a really positive, you know, can do, I believe in you environment, they start to have a little pep in their step.
Mm-hmm.
They start to buy in, you know, to what you're telling them. And they start to, again, live up to it and believe it themselves. So we always know that people tell us all the time that we believed in them before they believed in themselves. And who can't say that? I mean, that's true for me, too.
Absolutely. I have more people. The only reason I even do this for 20 plus years is because someone said to me, do you know your voice matters, when I had no idea that I even had one. So that is a common denominator for people, that we see in each other what we, you know, we can't see. We can see it in someone else.
Exactly.
So here you are all these years later, and I can't get on Facebook one day without you're getting an award, you're going, you're at a meeting, you're on stage. You were on stage for something just a couple days ago. I know there's so many you can't keep up. But when you come back here and all that's out there and you kind of rerun all the things that are going on in your life and you think about the stuff we're talking about, you still get this fire going. I don't see it stopping anytime soon. What's the big world vision for Safe Haven? Because it sounds like you want to take over the world with this.
Well, our whole goal since day one has been to influence a paradigm shift, you know, with the way our nation and even the world deals with poverty issues. And, you know, instead of offering, you know, Band-Aid, quick fix, you know, type solutions that end up having unintentional consequences of making people's lives worse or generationally dependent on the system, you know, we knew that as a country, we have the money, you know. And I think what we needed to do is draw more on our know-how in terms of the private sector stepping up and saying, how do we create a model that is able to leverage public and private resources in a way that's integrated and embedded in the community that allows people a one-stop shop where they can go and start the process, you know, or prevent the catastrophic consequences from happening mm-hmm. when they have, you know, situations come up in their lives, like catastrophic medical expenses or, you know, a domestic violence situation or a job loss. You know, in 2010, well, I want to say about 56% of the people that we were serving here were homeless for the very first time because of the fact that they couldn't keep up with their mortgages right. and things like that. They didn't have any other issues.
It was one of the things that was really difficult. I think that people forget, you know, you're not your credit score. That's a commercial on television. There's so much more to our character than that. And people who were in that position through no fault of their own had nowhere mm-hmm. really to turn.
Right.
You had 56% of the people that were involved were those first-time people.
Yes.
Wow, that's a lot.
So it just goes to show that, you know, in America today, I want to say that at least 50% of the people in America are one paycheck away from being homeless. I mean, there's a recent study that came out that said, you know, people couldn't come up with $400, you know, if they needed it today. Mm-hmm. And that's how close people are, you know, to being in catastrophic situations. Mm-hmm. And then now we know more about the opioid epidemic. So
yes.
We are what I call a leading indicator. So that's another thing. At A Safe Haven, when we first started A Safe Haven, we noticed that the populations that we were serving were not the traditional people that we would expect, you know, people that grew up in poverty, people that grew up in bad situations, and they had no other way of life. There were people that were coming to A Safe Haven that were housewives, that had beautiful homes in the suburbs and children, and all of a sudden, you know, they go in for some surgery and they end up, you know, giving it all up to live on the streets. Doesn't happen, right? There had to be something that was making that happen. And we also noticed that about 80% of the people that were coming to A Safe Haven started out on painkillers. And we're now on heroin. Mm. So we knew decades ago that there was something really off with the system in terms of the path to heroin was really painkillers. And over the years, you know, those numbers have only gotten worse. So today we know that there's a national opioid epidemic, and now that we know that, we're starting to see more compassion for the issue of substance abuse, you know, disorders.
What do you do different here that's so effective than the stuff we don't see on the news? Because for most people, quite frankly, and we had this conversation when you were on the show I did a while back here in Chicago about the opioid epidemic and how the population's changing, as you say. It's not the predictable population. What are you doing differently here to offset that?
Well, we believe in really being agnostic, you know, in terms of the approach until we assess the individual, right? Today, there's a big movement for people to be put on medical assisted treatment, you know, so that's methadone, Suboxone, you know, all of those types of drugs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those drugs aren't new. They've been around for a very, very long time. But we believe that, you know, each individual is different, so it isn't a one-size-fits-all. You have to actually get to know the individual in terms of what is the underlying issues that are going on. Is there a substance abuse disorder? Is there unemployment issues, unstable housing issues? Are there children involved? You know, are there other mental health issues? Are there dual diagnosis issues happening? And that is what informs our protocol in terms of making sure that these people are connected to the right services at the right time. So the last thing you want to do is take someone straight off the street that's been dealing with substance abuse issues
right.
and put them into a job training program.
Right, not going to work.
Or get them a job.
Sure.
No, you have to make sure that it's a natural progression that mm-hmm. leads them to ultimately, you know, an employment situation and permanent housing situation. So a lot of times in our haste, you know, we want to solve this. We want
sure.
to solve it right now. So, you know, we make decisions like, you know, well, let's get them on, you know, on something, you know, that's going to replace the drug that they've been on without looking at the whole person, you know.
You've mentioned a couple times about the getting to the root cause of things. That seems to be like the mantra with everything you do. Getting the root cause of the opioid thing, getting the root cause of homelessness, why there's so many veterans on the street, that root cause thing. I'm just fascinated that you're, because you don't hear that very often. Usually it's let's, you know, fix it at the surface, which never works. All this time, do you think because you're all focused on the root cause is the reason you're having the success you have?
Oh, of course. Of course. And people get to stay here. The average length of stay is about 90 days. But there's people that have stayed here up to a year, because if it's a woman, for example, that comes out of prison, And she's got children in the system. Now, by the way, 70% of the women in prison have kids, you know. So if that woman's referred to a safe haven, you know, as a reentry program, we're able to get her into treatment programs, education programs, job training programs. You know, we're able to reunite her here with her children. Now she's getting parenting skills and she's working with the children and, you know, getting them to school on time and making sure they have a healthy breakfast, making sure she's working with that teacher as an ally and a friend and a partner and helping their child. And so this is all stuff that we help that parent do. So that takes time, and getting them out into a job that where they'll be able to afford to support themselves and their children. And if there's cases where, you know, they need to have some subsidies, we find those too, you know. But the goal is to really help anchor them at every level. So for everyone that walks in the door, our goal from day one is planning for success. We want to anchor them socially. We want to anchor them economically. We want to anchor them, you know, housing-wise and with their networks, you know, in terms of, you know, AA meetings or people that are they're going to stay in touch with, so that if they have, you know, anything that's going to come up that may be a setback or a trigger, they know how to deal with it.
You have, it seems like, a deep compassion for people. Is that accurate?
Well, I think I do.
But I mean, but you put it into action. It's one thing to just, I mean, I listen to you speak and I'm thinking, I'm putting myself across the table from going, how many people have you talked to like this in 20 some odd years? Thousands?
I don't know.
Whether they're sitting. Yeah. Well, I mean, but you get the sense that this is something that you, it is so deep in you that it's almost, so for most people listening to this, they get their view of what's going on with people that would come here from the news. Right. It's a clip. It's this fast. And there's no chance except for judgment in that. Well, if you know, why aren't they better? Why are they this? I walked in downstairs. I was greeted warmly. John, nice to meet you. You know, thanks for coming. Okay, we're talking. And you don't see that on the news. You don't see this on the news. You don't get all this on the news. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it for you to battle back against kind of the image that people have of someone who, you're talking about these moms that come out of prison or that have kids in prison or that come stay here. Again, we see 30 seconds of that. Mm. You're dealing with this 24/7, 365. How difficult is it for you, or is it difficult to battle against the stigma of how the rest of the world sees people that you're taking care of?
Well, I want to say the stigma has been one of the biggest challenges, because we are a judgmental society. And, you know, I have to say, you know, I personally was probably one of those people that, you know, walked past people that are homeless and said, boy, I wish, you know, they'd make better decisions, because, you know, you make your bed, you lie in it, right?
Yeah.
That's how we always believed. And you move on. And again, as we started helping a few people out, we started to learn their stories and understood, you know, that these people actually have encountered overwhelming challenges that any one of us would have ended up in the same boat if we had those types of things happen. So I do have, you know, a deep compassion, and there's so many stories out there that, you know, give me reason to continue to be extremely passionate, because we're fighting for real lives here. And, you know, whatever misconceptions we have about the people that are out there that are in crisis, we have to rethink it, because, you know, there's people that are dying out there, you know, and because, you know, of catastrophic situations that are happened in their lives that are no fault of their own, like you said. I mean, my son, for example, just he had a surgery on his foot, and he was given, you know, painkillers. And I was just calling him every day and going to see him. I'm like, okay, don't take the painkillers. You know, take some ibuprofen.
Chew on a stick.
Exactly. Yeah. and he, you know, he needed the painkillers, so he took them. And he had surgery last Tuesday, and today is Tuesday, so a week ago. And today he's in the office, and he's saying, oh, my God. He goes, I'm going through withdrawals. He says, you know, I'm feeling, you know, I'm sweating. He says, I feel, like, shaky. And, you know, it's because I stopped taking the painkillers.
Sure.
And I said, well, that's, imagine, and he still has like 10 days worth of painkillers left.
Wow.
I said, imagine, you know, the people that don't know any better, and they take the full length of the prescriptions, because it's easy to get addicted to painkillers, you know, after 3 days, you know, is what they say. And I just was having him speak to one of our former residents, now employee, and I told him, I said, so, you know, what do you think, Angel, you know, about the idea of the painkillers? And he asked my son what he was taking, and he told him, he says, whoa, he says, that's bad. you know, and this is coming from someone who was an addict for like 30 years, who, you know, understands, you know, the type of damage that was caused in his life because of those painkillers. And I think that, you know, again, you know, it's closer than we think, you know, everyone, you know, getting a prescription for a wisdom tooth taken out, you just have to, I mean, I believe you need to take painkillers. I'm not saying no, but you know, some people have a much higher propensity to become addicted than others. So I say, you know, err on the side of caution, you know, take as little as you need and try to, you know, move on and take something else. And I'm a big fan of turmeric, anti-inflammatory.
Humans don't like pain. We'll do just about anything to avoid pain. Unfortunately, it's like compound interest of the worst kind. And I'm telling a financial person about compound interest. But I've learned over my lifetime, most of the time I try to do something to avoid pain, I just create more. It's just in a different way.
Right.
And you got to deal with that.
Right.
And then you got to deal with this. So
yeah.
A couple of days ago, I was at Schurz High School, where I went here in the city. And for the first time that I know of, we put together like an alumni group and all that kind of stuff. And we're giving away $5,000 scholarships to students that are there. And so there's a bunch of old geezers like me that played football back in when, you know, Nixon was president, and some other people. And we had raised this money, and there were three donors who put $1,000 each in and all this other stuff. And so this is a big deal for us to do this. So out of there was 35 applicants for these five scholarships, and it got down to 9. The school kind of culled out what they thought was, you know, who had the best chance of making it. So on Sunday, we went in and sat there, and we listened to these 9 young people tell us about their lives. I couldn't believe it. All of them undocumented, I think, and willing to say it, saying that they don't know what their future holds. Two of them were basically in the Dreamers program, waiting to see if that ever gets passed. And myself and a guy that I grew up with, we've known each other 50 years, we both sat there with our jaws hanging open. Mm-hmm. None of the obstacles these 9 people, these young people had, all 16, 17, 18 years old, we couldn't even imagine what it's like to have to go live in somebody else's house and sleep on the couch. We couldn't imagine not having papers because we were born here. We could not imagine 2 families living in 2 rooms with 10 people. And they went on and on. And you know what? All of them want a biomedical engineer, lawyer, designer, doctors, nurses. Every single one of them had dreams that were so much bigger than the circumstances that they were living through. We were shocked. Shocked, shocked, shocked. Mm-hmm. So we listened to them for about 4 hours. They came in, they talked, we peppered them with questions. There was 4 of us sitting there. And I asked them, every single one of them, what was the ROI on us if we gave them $1,000. Now, most of them have some financial stuff happening through the colleges they've been accepted to, UIC, DePaul, one's UW-Madison, there's one in New York, SIU, you know, so and one's going to Wright College, wants to work in automotive, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's this kid, wants to work in automotive. His dad opened a shop 35 years ago, had a heart attack 2 years ago. He goes to school full-time and then runs the shop after school.
Wow.
He's 18, and he wants to run the shop. Mm-hmm. So he needs his automotive certificate. And I was like, how do you say no to that? Mm-hmm. So he has some financial aid. But I asked everyone, and what's the return on investment? And they all said the same thing. We would never let you down. You don't hear that much. You don't certainly don't hear it in the news.
Well, that's what I just told you.
Exactly. That's why I brought it up.
When my friends got me this job, you know, as much as it hurt, you know, to go to work every day because it was brutal. Mm-hmm. Brutal. It was cutthroat.
Yeah.
You know, and the attrition rate was very, very high. Yeah. I mean,
It's like the movie Wall Street and all that. Yeah.
No one would talk to me because it was like I was the one of like 3 women, you know, out of an office of 50.
Jeez.
And I was the only one that was of color, you know, in that office. And, you know, I was, they had a leaderboard on the wall, so you could see where everybody's production was for the month. A few months, I was at the bottom, right? I was at the bottom until I had an epiphany and said, you know what, I can eavesdrop. I could try to be, you know, what everybody else is in the office and try to say things the way they say it, but I'm never going to be them. And
sure,
never,
sure.
So, but then the opposite side of that argument was they're never going to be me either.
True.
So what can I do
right.
to differentiate myself? Mm. And, you know, but the whole goal was not that I wanted to, you know, live this, you know, hugely financially successful life. And, you know, I see myself doing that, but it was my motivation was more important to me was I didn't want to let my friends down.
There it is.
And my family
and
down,
your family, yeah,
right. Yeah, and so I went into debt. You know, I mean, I was in a straight commission job, so I went into debt.
Wow, that's rough duty. Yeah, straight commission.
A straight commission. I went into debt.
You could starve on that.
I had to buy a wardrobe. Yeah. I had to pay for my license, you know, to get licensed. I studied for months, you know, and months without making any money. I mean, it was totally backwards. You know, it was like, wait a minute, I have a degree. You know, they should be paying me.
Right.
But, you know, it was, again, you know, all on me to get all that done. And I wasn't going to go through all of that. And now all this money and not succeed.
Sure.
So I ended up, you know, thankfully leaving on my own terms after 13 years. Hmm.
You said something a couple minutes ago that a young lady said it when we were interviewing them for the scholarship. You know, we asked, why do you want to do this? And she said, well, I don't let people down, but I want to prove that someone of color can make it. But I have to tell you, and I need your help with this. I don't know if it works for me or against me. I went to a diverse high school. I've been around people. I've never once thought of that when I didn't see her as a person of color in front of me. However, it's a factor that I don't have to ever deal with. No one's ever refused me things because of how I look. And I don't know what that's like or had the difficulty that when she said that, both this friend of mine, I looked at each other, thought, here's another thing. We have no idea how difficult just that is.
Mm-hmm. Just getting your foot in the door.
Can you explain a little bit? Expand on that?
So the idea of getting a job in a career that, you know, obviously wasn't, it wasn't an affirmative action thing. You know, they didn't have to hire me.
Right.
There was no requirement. And I certainly didn't have any of the credentials. You know, I had no experience, right? I had no book to bring, you know, no book of business to bring into the industry. They were taking someone that was green around, just completely green off the street and making this investment.
It's like a movie almost.
Yeah. So I actually, not to show my age, but, you know, if you watch the movie Pursuit of Happiness.
You're talking about Chris Gardner's movie?
Chris Gardner's movie. Okay, so I worked at the same firm he did.
Come on.
So I believe he worked like in San Francisco,
yeah.
And I worked in Chicago, but we were at the same firm
because
I read the book.
Yeah.
And all of the people from the firm, you know, in terms of the leadership, were people that I also knew from
having
worked
met him?
I met him briefly, but, you know, I always say I'm waiting for the Latino version to come out. That'll be me.
Never know.
But as far as, you know, I honestly, at that time, too, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there was no proactive diversity agendas or nothing like that. This is the 80s.
You're on your own.
Yeah, I was completely on my own. And, you know, I didn't really focus on that too much. You know, I didn't focus on the fact that I was, you know, different than everybody else. To me, it was about being as competitive as I could be. And I just didn't think about myself being a woman either. I just thought of myself as being in the game, you know, and ready to compete. And, you know, I had to do whatever it took to completely, you know, hone my skills and make myself, you know, competitive. Mm-hmm. And I didn't stay on the bottom of the leaderboard. I ended up moving way up on the leaderboard and becoming one of the top producers, you know, because of the fact that I really did eventually differentiate myself and turn being Nellie Vasquez into an asset and a subject matter expert in the area that I was focused on at a time that nobody was thinking about it. So I got lucky because I started investing in Mexico before NAFTA. You know, so all of my investments, you know, ended up, you know, doing extremely well because privatization was a big initiative.
Have you always been this confident or is this earned?
Earned.
Is it earned?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I used to cry to work every day. Every day I'd get up and I'd be like in tears. I used to carry a bottle of Marine, you know, for my eyes so they wouldn't see how red they were because I was taking so much, you know, a beating, you know, being rejected every day because I cold called, you know. And it was hard to build a book of business, you know, on cold calls. And I realized that, you know, I had to go after the wildcatter, you know, the guys that were, you know, the high risk, you know, type of investor. And those are the people that I connected with the most, you know, and ended up doing really well with.
What is one of the big things that you took from that life to help build this life? Is there one big, or is it a lot of little pieces from?
Well, everything. I think that my ability to do research, you know, was the biggest thing that informed me and gave me the confidence. My husband, too, the confidence to pursue this, you know, because the more research we did, the more we realized that this whole war on drugs thing.
Good in the headlines. That's about it.
Follow the money.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we've always learned to follow the money.
Yeah.
And what we found was the vast majority, like 97 cents of every dollar on the war on drugs, was going after supply reduction, which meant the Coast Guard, right?
Yes.
How do we go after these drug dealers?
Yeah.
How do we strengthen the laws? How do we build more prisons with this money to lock up all those people that are using drugs and dealing drugs? So that was the trend. I mean, we were looking at third grade reading levels, and we were saying, hey, these third graders, you know, probably aren't going to graduate from high school, and likelihood is they're going to end up in the system. We got to prepare
for
that.
You went way deep on this.
We really, really did. Wow. So for me, the research piece was really, really a key factor. So we saw the we projected out that at this rate, the people that is at the end of the day have a disease, right? They have a substance abuse disorder. And that's a disease, according to American Medical Association, since the 50s. And the way we're taking the resources on the war on drugs, and we're not doing anything to address demand reduction, just from an economist's perspective, we knew that this did not spell, you know, this was not a good trajectory for people that were dealing with these issues. And if it's a disease, diseases spread. And the definition of a disease is it's chronic, it's progressive, and it leads to death if it's left untreated, which is true.
Sure.
For substance abuse disorders, we see it every day now. 72,000 people OD'd last year and died, more than all wars put together, you know. And it's still not, you know, got the you know, attention that it deserves by all of us as a society to say, we must step up, we must do better, because not only is it affecting real lives, but it's also affecting our pocketbook, because we saw that as being completely financially unsustainable.
One of the things, and I've learned this over time, that the number one cause in this country of bankruptcy is medical bills that they can't be paid. And that puts people in very precarious positions, in some ways through no fault of their own. It's ridiculous, skyrocketing, all that kind of stuff. I can barely make it through the news at night because it's basically infomercial for drug news, accident, drug. And I don't know what the answer totally is. You're dealing with people on the backside of this, not the front side of this. We've covered a lot of that, but the last few minutes here, because I know you got stuff to do. You've been doing this so long. Is there like a big aha takeaway that summarizes? This podcast is Life 2.0, an enhanced version of life. You're enhancing so many lives, and your staff, all these people here. How do you, at the end of the day, what's the big aha for you in all this? There's got to be a good one.
Yeah, it is, 100%. I mean, I get to know a lot of the people that we serve, and I get to, you know, relish in their success, you know. And there's a woman, for example, that graduated from our program in 2012. Her name is Bianca. She's written a book.
Really?
You know, and she's, you know, now owns a four-bedroom home. She was homeless for 36 years, living on the streets. A woman in her 50s, right? Finally, after the seventh time that she came out of prison. She got released and went back to the judge and begged him to send her to a safe haven, because she knew going home and going back to a friend's house and sleeping on the couch was not going to be a good outcome. So she ended up getting in our program and stayed here for about 8 months. We were able to, you know, start from the beginning with her and getting her into treatment, getting her into, you know, volunteering and doing different things. And in those 8 months, you know, we were able to get her life back on track and ended up helping her get a job and helping her get an apartment. And she stayed here for a full month after she already had paid rent on her apartment and was scheduled to leave because she was afraid to leave. We finally had to kick her out of the nest, right? So she went. We gave her a little care package. And, you know, so it's stories like that. I mean, she keeps me posted. She's reunited with all of her kids. You know, she has several children who are now adults that she didn't get to raise. Her family did. Her family early on in her life had sent her to Club Med type treatment programs, you know, and none of that worked. And so, you know, her story just keeps getting better and better. I mean, and there's another woman that just left. I met her parents, a father actually, in Connecticut. I went to a funeral, you know, and it was in New Haven. And he came up to me. My host, you know, said to him what I did. So he came up to me and said he had a problem with the daughter. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not, you know, in Connecticut, but if you can get her to Chicago, I can help her then.
Sure.
So he ended up, you know, getting his daughter like a month or two after we had met off the streets by telling her, look, you know, I'm either going to start planning your funeral, or I'm going to send you with a one-way plane ticket to Chicago to send you to a safe haven. She took him up on his offer, and she didn't want to originally, but she came. And she just left. She was here for about 7 months. And, you know, night and day, you know, she was here, you know, disheveled, you know, looking broken and tired. And she left here, you know, just glowing and beautiful and, you know, very well spoken, huge potential there. I can't wait to hear what that story turns out to be. She has a 14-year-old daughter that she's just went back to be reunited with, you know, and, you know, I can't possibly
written
get
a book
to know
about yet?
Everybody.
I mean, this is, what a book this
I'm
would
working
be.
On it.
I would imagine so.
So I actually have my very first book that just came out.
Yeah.
It's called Today's Inspired Leader. So I'm a chapter in that book.
Yeah.
And I just, so now we're working on the full version, you know, but, you know, what we are living in right now, this is a very important time that you're here, and we're happy. I'm so excited to be talking to you because the future does rest on us, on all of us doing our homework and playing a role, you know, either in advocating, volunteering, donating, participating in events, and making sure that we are the voice of the people that don't have a voice, you know. And if we don't hold ourselves accountable and we don't hold leadership accountable for making the right decisions on behalf of the type of society that we all want to be proud to live in and to leave as a legacy for the next generation, then we own it. We own the fact that we got here. I don't want to own the fact that we didn't dig ourselves out of it.
The bottom line is this. Right where you are is where you can make the most difference. As Nellie finished up that little conversation, it's on us. This is our time to make a serious, constructive difference. Instead of walking past someone who is in need, maybe you help them get up just a little bit. And if you're a walker or a runner, you want to get involved and join the nation's largest 5K run to end homelessness on July 13th. That's coming up here in Chicago. And the best place to join, register, sponsor, what have you, is at www.runtoendhomelessness.org. Walkers welcome, and kids under 12 get to run for free. And all this, of course, benefits the programs of the Safe Haven Foundation. And and finally, on this note, as a veteran myself, and I've seen a lot of veterans who fall through the cracks, the work that they're doing at Safe Haven, to me, offsets every single negative headline you've ever heard about what's wrong with the VA. There's somebody stepping up and filling the darkness with light. And that's exactly what they do at a Safe Haven. And if you want to get more information, easy to find them online. Support these folks in a big way, because what goes around comes around. www.asafehaven.org will give you every bit of information you could possibly imagine and connect you with some people that are doing an incredible work in the world. Until next time, be well, safe travels, adios.